If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Karma You podcast. This is your host, Chloe Brotheridge. I'm a coach, a hypnotherapist, and I'm the author of The Anxiety Solution and Brave New Girl. And this podcast is all about helping you to become your calmest, happiest, and most confident self. Today I'm speaking to the incredibly interesting Tony Riddle, aka the Natural Lifestylist. Tony is a natural lifestyle coach, and he spent the last 18 years developing and refining a robust way of life based on the principles of a natural lifestyle. Central to his continuing exploration is the question, what makes the human animal successful in the modern world? We have a really interesting discussion all about the link between our disconnection from nature and the levels of depression and anxiety that we experience. Tony teaches us how we can rewild ourselves, what we can do at work, at home, and in our daily lives to connect back to nature and gain all the health and mental well-being benefits of doing that. And he shares loads of practical tips on everything from the plants that you need to have in your house to clean the air, to how to sleep better, to how to squat better, and so much more. I think you're going to really find this episode quite fascinating and mind-blowing. So let's get into the interview with Tony Riddle. I'd love to invite you to check out my new app, the Karma You app. We are so proud of this app. It's been about 2 years in the making. It's a great app, I have to say. It's not a crappy app that was made in a rush with bad design. It works incredibly well. There are so many tools in there, meditations, journaling, ways to track your progress, CBT exercises to help with anxiety. It really is like having a therapist in your pocket. You can find it in the App Store. It's getting incredible reviews so far. The Karma You app, please check it out. I think you're going to love it. This episode is sponsored by my favourite activewear brand, Sweaty Betty. Their all-female design team source the best technical fabrics, which means their products perform under the toughest conditions and feel amazing on your skin. All products are also wearer-trialled by female staff to ensure they perform and flatter and fit the female body. If the staff don't love it, it doesn't get made. There are so many activewear brands to shop from, but Sweaty Betty is special because all their products, from run and yoga to swim and ski, are engineered to last. This is not fast fashion, it's high quality. And I have several pieces from Sweaty Betty that I've had for years and I continue to wear and love. Sweaty Betty now has a host of sustainable products, including their Super Sculpt leggings made from post-consumer plastic bottles. Their Italian fleece has been replaced with a recycled cotton blend alternative, and they are reducing the amount of consumer packaging sent to customers. Sweaty Betty are offering listeners 20% off when you enter the promo code KARMAYOU on their website. You'll also find the link in the show notes. So 20% off at Sweaty Betty when you enter the code KARMAYOU. That's CALMERYOU. Check out their stuff. I think you're going to love it. Welcome, Tony. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for inviting me in. Brilliant. I've had a great day, actually. It's been lots of nature today. So just literally arrived from Hampstead Ponds now and cold dip in the icy water. Yeah.
Sounds,
can't beat that.
Sounds energising.
Yeah. Epic start.
I'd love to hear from you, and for people who don't know who you are and what you do, what is it that you do and how do you help people, and what's been your journey to get to where you are today?
Wow, that's a big one, isn't it? My name is Tony Riddle. Yeah, I'm also known as the AKA the Natural Lifestylist. What does that mean? Well, before that, essentially just rewilding humans, introducing them to ways of living that are more in sync with human biology, and then bringing that forward into everyday environments to enable us to thrive, not just survive. And what I mean by that is most of us just survive and we don't even realize it. What we've normalized, you know, the anxiety, millions of different diseases, 100 different autoimmune diseases, it's just become normalized, right? So it's like, how do we get through that, and how do we see through it? And for me, it's always been looking at nature to have the answers. Like, nature's the cure, let's say. And the more and more I went into that, the more that you can see that these natural beings of the world just don't have sometimes even words for what we have. Like insomnia, there's no word for it in some of the tribes, right? Because they have no connection to it. So anxiety or even cancers in some tribes, you know? So for me, it was always about, yeah, how do I find that connection? It wasn't really resonating with people. They couldn't really relate to it. It's partly because we were using language like zoo humans and wild humans, you know? Sounds great, romantic, but people didn't really relate to the wild human, and they also didn't like the fact it ought to be called a zoo human, let's say. So somewhere in the mix, I was approached by an editor from the Style magazine, Sunday Times Style magazine, and she was writing a piece on 6 best coaches. So my ego was like, ooh, 6 best coaches, yeah, I'd love to do that. And so we sit down, we start chatting, and then she says, okay, I was expecting it to be really about movement, because she could see that there was an influence through natural movement with me and a lot of my clients. And then as I started to expand on the whole philosophy, it was not just about finding natural ways of moving, it was finding natural ways of sleeping, natural ways of digesting, natural ways of eating, natural ways of breathing, and then the social community and the spiritual context of what it was to be a natural being. And she thought, okay, this is much bigger, so how about we do a full feature on it? Let's give you 2 pages. And then that became like nature style, the natural lifestylist. It was obvious for me after that. And then all of a sudden it was like waking up the next day and things just exploding, because it was suddenly relatable, I guess. So that's kind of where it's at now. That's kind of where I am at this part of the journey. I mean, leading up to that, it's been huge. It's been a huge journey. That's the unraveling of Tony, I guess, that's enabled me to sit here as Tony 2.0, I call him, you know. So I had a upbringing in a village that was kind of a concrete existence, let's say, and punctuated in amongst that, there was a little piece of nature that us kids went to, and maybe an hour or so a week, but it was a moment to express kind of our physicality and connect to something deeper, I guess. You know, partly we could just kick our shoes off and climb trees and play in the streams, and then suddenly it was back into the concrete existence like everyone else's experience as an urbanite. And TV and sitting in front of the box and, you know, just having that kind of social experience at the very beginning, that was kind of the templates. ADHD, dyslexia, you could throw a lot into the mix, really. And it's really just this craving for being outside. So I'd sit in a classroom, like tapping, looking out the window, but really with this huge desire to need to move. And then had such a terrible education. It was like one of the worst, I think. And then found myself in the army later on, partly to avoid the drugs and the alcohol and the crime that was basically just normalized within my social group. And it was a form of escapism. And so I found myself in the military, and I spent 3.5 years, really, again, I guess, going back to that 1 hour expressing my physicality as a young boy out in nature. That punctuated in amongst my week. I now had that in the army. I could really express that. But then eventually it just got to a point where I just found myself a bit lost, even in the military. And then unfortunately found myself dropping back into the same social patterns as what I'd been trying to escape, you know. So it's kind of, there's roots in there. And then someone saved me. They said, well, have you thought about personal training? Have you thought about maybe have a look at personal training? You're into physical self, you look great. And I was like, this sounds great. And so you move into London, I've got a gig, maybe I can set you up. So that was the next step for me, and it kind of already I could feel, this is for me. So already I was exploring that. Then I had a position in a personal training studio, my first personal training position. Fortunately, I walked into a place that didn't have gym equipment, no resistance machines. It was just a studio, so you had to really learn your craft. And the people that were in there were mainly 40-something women. Their husbands were commuting into the city in the Marylebone, and they had absolutely no interest in what the current paradigm probably of personal training was, which was a little bit sabotaged by bodybuilding and fitness models. And so it became about more core stability, and it was just a new language I was learning, and I discovered Pilates. And then from Pilates, I then, skipping forward a few years, found myself in my own Pilates studio, one-on-ones and just joint sessions. And then I took on a bigger practice. So I had like six practitioners working for me, all equipment-based. Loved the original philosophy. It made perfect sense to me. And there's images of Joseph Pilates. You know, he's a middleweight professional boxer, lost an eye in a fight, gymnast, circus performer, stuff that people didn't really know about him. Even his cold immersion, there's images of him in his pants standing in the snow, you know. So there was something really, I was intrigued by it, you know. So I started to look deeper into that, and I found his original system that was called Controlology. There was crawling patterns and more about body weight and understanding where weight should be even when you're standing. And it was a very different terminology, a very different language at that point. And then I was involved with a company called Wild Fitness. And Wild Fitness had a retreat space in Kenya in Watamu, and they were taking zoo humans and turning them into wild humans, except they were still teaching the current paradigm of personal training, but just in nature. So they kind of understood it. We take zoo humans into nature. That was the aspect that was working. It's just the understanding that there's nature that can, there's a filter for nature in everything we look at, right? So it could be the movement, the sleep aspect of it. So how do we wire that in? So at that point, another great mentor of mine, Nicholas Romanoff, walked in, and he helped me understand a specific posture that everyone walks into when they're running, when you're climbing, any particular movement pattern. You could observe it through his method called the pose, which was, there's a skill and it has a technique, a mind and a physiology to it. And suddenly I looked at my Pilates practice with that filter, and it was like, oh my God, well, people are just coming in with symptoms. From a lifestyle, it's not, I'm just giving them symptom relief. I'm not going to the cause. I'm teaching them to lie down and move around on a piece of equipment to unravel the tension and their compromised body from their everyday lifestyle. So what creates that? And it was like, well, okay, the obvious things are their footwear was one, and then it was the chair. Okay, sitting, sedentary lifestyle. So then if it was all about the money, I could have just kept inviting them in and just dealing with the same situation. Oh, it's just hips and it's just feet and you can just correct their posture. But I started to look at, there must be a more natural system, a natural movement, way of moving. And so another mentor, Erwan Nakor, who's he has a system called MoveNat, which is about observing certain movement patterns that we all carry out in nature. It's based on George Hebert's work. George Hebert was like a French marine officer in the 1800s and studied all indigenous populations and realized that they had these incredible physicality, ability to move, and just compared to his own marines, well, could just outperform, let's say. And what is it they're doing differently? So that's kind of where the military assault course came from. That's the origins of it. That observing they all could balance, run, lift, carry, throw, defend, swim, jump. There was just a whole protocol to it. So Erwan's work was very much like that. But I could then apply Nicholas's pose method to that. So then I could see the appropriate pose and what was needed. So what was happening was, instead of taking what Wild Fitness would have called zoo humans and putting them through this exercise program, and expecting a natural outcome, I had to take them back so they understood the appropriate postures and techniques within those disciplines first, and then their physiology would start to adapt to it. And from there, I opened up a gym. I closed my Pilates studio. It felt very much like being a fraud having that. You know, again, you could carry on that path and just give people symptom relief. So we used to joke, and it was like, we called it movement therapy, but it was more like movement and therapy, where people would come down, they'd lie on the reformer, and they'd be doing this series of exercises, but they'd also be telling you about their problems, you see. So I was like, okay, it's still lifestyle. There's something in there. What is it there? What are the symptoms? And what's the cause? Let's go into the cause. So I started with movement. That was the very first layer of it, really, really just honing a movement practice that was natural to people in a gym facility. And three of us opened that practice. And we had different influences. And then barefoot running kind of came through with a book called Born to Run, which was Chris McDougall. That blew things up for us. And we got involved with a barefoot brand who I now work with, which is called Vivo Barefoot. So that meant I could then look at the way the feet were behaving and have them perform naturally, but in an urban environment. So they had some kind of protection. And then we understood there were particular postures and protocols that we could get people to just become more efficient as movers. Then eventually the philosophy started to open up, and I piloted the first wild fitness retreat out of the Isle of Wight. So then it was an opportunity to bring more in, more of this natural movement rather than modern day exercise into a natural habitat. And then there was more availability around sleep, more discussions around sleep, and then the core philosophy. And I started to branch off with another coach, and then the two other people I set that business up jumped ship. So they moved out of the gym facility. And then I something made me stay. It was like I think it was the ego, and also I had my father's influence. He had a business, and I watched him literally just, everything went in the business. And we very rarely saw him. He was home on like Sundays if we were lucky. Mm-hmm. And we just watched it unravel, pretty much lost everything in that process, I guess, including him a little, you know. And something inside me, I felt like I was playing out the same pattern. And I'd stayed in the business far too long, trying to support it with my own means in the end, because we'd lost two other directors in the sense. And then I was holding a big workshop, and this is the turning point for me. And people had come over from all over, standing in a room, and I'm there preaching about a philosophy about zoo humans and wild humans and living naturally. And a tube train kind of went past the building, and in that moment it just shook the doors of the building. And it was, oh my God, it was like, again, that the message of I'm a fraud. I'm standing here teaching people about how to live a natural lifestyle in an urban setting. Yet I've just worked 16 hours yesterday. I've had no sleep. My diet's a mess. My skin's a mess. I'm completely fatigued. I'm on the borderline of adrenal fatigue. I'm just not happy. I'm basically probably depressed at this point. And it was just the moment, and I'd gone bankrupt literally within a week after that whole thing. Just let it go, and everything that I'd feared, I'd managed to just unravel within a week. The fear of, oh, what if I lose the business? The fear of what people would think, the shame, the guilt. And out of that adversity, suddenly built Tony 2.0. And it was just, I think that was the adversity I needed at that time, was the closure of a business that I've been deeply holding on to. So I then went off on a bit of a journey, and it was how do you rebuild yourself? So luckily I had a very supporting wife and kids at that stage that were just, you need to take as much time as you do. So breath work came in for me first, meditation. And then, of course, I had all the information, I had all the knowledge. It was just now I had to experience it and put it into practice. Instead of just standing there in front of an audience telling them how they should be using these protocols, it was like, I'm the man in the audience, and this is what I need to be doing. So I guess I had to experience it. And then out of that, of course, you come out with wisdom. You know, you have the knowledge, and then you have to really experience it. And I think unless you've gone through real anxiety, and if you've gone through depression, unless you've gone through breakdowns, and you've had to, and then you see them as breakthroughs, that for me, that was the real turning point. And people could relate to that again. It was like, I've been there. I know it feels rubbish, you know. But I also know you have everything inside of you. You're an amazing being to turn it around and be the change and then be an example to others. So that was kind of the meditation for me, going into that voice a lot, you know. And then more recently, I undertook an event where I decided I wanted to show our human potential, our human physicality. And so I chose to run from Land's End to John O'Groats, which I did barefoot. Why barefoot? Well, because it kind of, you know, people, they can't relate to it to start with, like, what? But it gets that initial, wow, that sounds fascinating, you know. Well, I'm just going to go and run the length of the UK, but I'm going to do it barefoot. So it really raised that socially extreme eyebrow and created a platform. And with that platform, it meant I could raise awareness for a bigger picture. You know, my whole thing's around living a natural lifestyle and reconnecting to people to nature. And this was the real opportunity for that. Well, here's what we can do. We can run barefoot. That's natural. We should be able to get up and run each day. That's also natural. Where's the stage for this? Well, it's nature. Okay, so how do we do that? So it was then an opportunity to raise funds for 6 organisations. And then interview sustainability experts along the route. That was the plan, with this idea that I mean, there's so much around the environment and sustainability now, isn't there? You know, and lots of people even striking in the streets, but it's how many of those people are actually out in nature and connecting to it and really understanding what it is they're trying to save, you know? Because if I can't relate to it and I can't connect to it, what chance do I have of saving something if I'm not immersed in it? So from that experience, it meant that even towards the end of the run, I felt that I'd literally just become nature at one point. I was out there for so long in this meditation state of running, which I then called the pilgrimage for me. It was like an opportunity to come back with, wow, this is incredible. That if we're really out there for that long, you understand how precise it all is. And it's all happening for you. There were just people that would appear on the route exactly when I needed them, when I felt most broken, or someone that had to open a road for me. And it just happened, this guy was there. Oh, by the way, just to let you know, I've opened the road up for you. And you're like, what? You know, just, they're there. They're just there at that specific time. But usually we're so cluttered up with information, or I have to be at this meeting or this appointment at this time. We miss those cues, those subtle nudges. But this adventurers, I had an opportunity to really tune into it. And then I faced adversity even on that. I had a bad injury towards the end of it. I'd managed to sprain an ankle leaping over something in a stream, and I couldn't even load my left foot at that stage. It's completely swollen. Really just brutal injury to get right at the end when you've got 3 days left to complete 30 miles a day for 30 days. That's the time frame I'd given myself. So then I then went through all the protocols I'd learned again. So for me, it was another adversity. And now I have this kind of cave. I called it the pain cave. And there's a bear sitting at the back of the pain cave. And there's a log at the back of the cave. And I go into the cave, and I enter the cave, and I sit next to the bear. And I have a conversation with the bear. And the bear, on this occasion... said, it's okay for you. You're much stronger than I am. You can choose. You can choose to go out into the light or stay in the darkness at the back of the cave. Out in the light or back in the cave. I can only sit at the back of the cave. So what are you going to choose? And in that moment, it was enough for me. And it flipped a switch that enabled me to get my thoughts from being a victim. I'm not going to be able to run. I'm not going to be able to complete this thing. To I'm healing. And it's in instances like that, the adversity, again, you realize that it's all perception. It's just literally perception. It's a perception of a moment, and that we are just a vessel. And the mind is incredible, really, if you really want to go in there and unravel it and just see what's available. Human potential is way beyond what I'd expected and what I'd expect in my expectations going into the run. Again, that was really about the physical self, but it came out as, oh my God, the mind is... we're just incredible beings, you know, if we really let it go. That's a bit of a waffle.
No, that's so interesting. So this pain cave, was that something that spontaneously came to you? Is that something, a practice that you return back to? Or what
it's something
that?
I go back to. Yeah. So it's, in training, sometimes, you know, if I was pushing it in training, of course, you get to the point where you feel like you're completely fatigued, and that's the cave. You have to basically somehow get yourself out of there to face the next session. But again, I look at that through stuff I've had in the past when it's been breakdown, depression, anxiety, anything that was flagged up in the past. It's the same thing. It's just a matter I have to go into the cave. And most of us are just fearful of going there. And I think you have to go there. That's where the deepest lessons are. You know, we're so fearful of anxiety, we're so fearful of depression, but at times that's where the most valuable lessons are. And we come out of it a much stronger being. But it's having the tools and the skills to get out of the cave. That's what I've learned now. You know, because we all go in there. I mean, it's just, I was talking about the ponds, that's a mini hit of adversity for me. And I take a lot of people through that process, or into the cold, or into ice. And when they first arrive, you can see they're really, really, you know, they're really, really anxious. That's the pain cave for them. We're about to go into the cave, right? And so what are the tools we can be using to be able to enter that and to down-regulate and to see the adversity differently, that it's a challenge, it's a micro-hit. We very rarely have real adversity, you know. Some of it's almost self-manufactured in a way, you know. I've got a few emails on here that I know I have to deal with today, you know, and I can already feel like I'm a little bit upregulated going into them. So what do I do about that? Do I stay upregulated, or do I use methods to downregulate so I see it differently? What do I mean about seeing it differently? You know, we revert back to our earliest traumas the moment we're stressed out. It's like, you know, the stuff that's happened in the first early years, let's say, what plays out for the rest of your life. That's like the templates. So up until the age of 7, let's say, those recordings that have occurred in those earliest years are what we play out for the rest of our lives. They're our templates that we've inherited through our tribes of influence or whoever. And the moment we're really upregulated, we start to go back into, say, the 3-year-old or the 4-year-old or the 6-year-old. It comes up, right? We don't know that because it's just what we operate at. It's like a subconscious pattern that comes up. So do I want to answer my email in that mindset, or do I want to get rid of the imposter and start to become the authentic self again? And that's what I learned within the practices. Like breath work is an incredible modality just for flipping that switch of perception to get you out of the cave immediately, so you can become the authentic self again, answering the email rather than the imposter, stressed out urbanite who's, you know, upregulated in a sense, that might not be given the quite the right response. And we can all relate to that. That's an email. That can even be a phone call. And that, as a parent, I see it. As a parent, it's like, you know, if you've got chaos going around the home and you maybe need to get an email done, and but the kids are going crazy. Is it the kids are going crazy? Or is it just your perception of the kids going crazy? And the moment you step back from that, and again, you go and have a chat with the bear, and he gives you some advice on, well, here's some breathing techniques you can be doing, or at least stare at some nature. And there's amazing studies of what can happen just by immersing in nature for 20 minutes, you know. So in Japan, it's like they took 260 individuals, studied them in 24 areas, and within 20 minutes, each one of those individuals has a 13.4% drop in their cortisol, their blood pressure and heart rate have dropped. And they'd return back to their parasympathetic rest and digest. So away from their sympathetic fight and flight. That's every one of those participants, right? So if we think of that, that's dropping them into that authentic self again. But we can't all do that in the office, or say in this environment now. I might have been really upregulated. What did we do before we started? I've just come off the tube. We sat and we breathed for 3 minutes before you start. And it just enables you to find you within the chaos again. So that's the cave for me, really. It's just, yeah, it's always with us, you know, and it's just finding ways, how can I get myself out of that experience?
And when you talk about breath work, what does that mean to you? And are there certain practices that people can be trying today to help themselves?
Yeah, there's really simple techniques, right? So there's different, it depends on where you are in the day. There's breath gurus out there, so I'll make it really simple, and I'll maybe put a few of them in here. So a guy that I work with is Arthur Paulines. He's an amazing breath coach. Alan Dolan, he's known as the breath guru. So they work with some systems like transformational breath, some of Wim Hof's work and down-regulating breath. And then there's really simple access, which is someone that we worked with, which is Eddie Stern's app, and it's just a breathing app you can download. And with that, rather than you having to count about breath, it just has a sound in the background, and you follow the sound with your breath, and you can just go off. It's like you can, it's like the entry into meditation you can find through that, just a simple breathing app. So down-regulating breath means that you're dropping yourself into parasympathetic, which is rest and digest. Right, so it's a more restful state. Heart rate, blood pressure drops, saliva will come up because you're rest and digest digestion. And then we have kind of up-regulating breath, which is about becoming more alert. So if it's, say, 3 o'clock, 3:30 usually for me, I might feel like, oh, just a little bit, I'm dropping a bit here. So what can I do? I could go smash the caffeine, or I could upregulate my breath. So then I choose more of a charging breath. So it's more of a 10 cycles. It's enough just to make you alert. Just that simple as that. Mm-hmm. And then just expand on that if you want to do 30 breaths or whatever. You can feel a little bit tingly from that sometimes, just because you're playing with oxygen, carbon dioxide levels. So we also use things like breath holds, which has become quite popular with Wim Hof's method. He's like the Iceman. And then so on the final out breath of that, you then hold your breath, and it will just help balance that system again. Back to parasympathetic, it's such an important tool, this. I mean, I coach a lot of people in breath just purely, again, going back to parenting. So we could use this as an example coming in here. I get onto the tube, tube's chaos. Sometimes just getting out of the tube can be chaos, let alone getting onto it. It's an alien environment. The air's not great. The lighting's terrible. So we've just normalized it, but on a subconscious level, it's just not a very natural environment. So you're never really going to get a natural outcome. It's very difficult to become very restful in that environment. Then everyone else has the same experience. So you're now surrounded by the energy of all of that, which can feel quite anxious. And then, so I'm going to be upregulated, a little bit anxious. And then I arrive at home to my door, and my kids have been waiting for Papa probably for 8 hours, right? And they wanted this amazing guy to come in the house who's their image of what Papa is and what their expectations are. Yet I have this craziness around me and I'm upregulated. So I will stop at the door and I just do very simple. It would work out as like a 4-second inhale through my nose and then a 6-second. And I just do 10 cycles. And then I walk in the door, and then it's a very different experience I'm coming in with. It's almost like I've left it at the doorstep, and I can walk in like Tony 2.0, not Tony Imposter again. So that's, you know, it's just working with different breath modalities. And I think you can explore with that. There's so many, like box breathing people talk about, which might mean 3 seconds in, then you hold for 3 seconds, 3 seconds out, and then you hold for 3 seconds. When is the best time for different breath techniques? Again, if you're upregulated, downregulate. If it's before bedtime, definitely just go to the long exhale. So it could be 3 seconds in, 4 seconds in, longer exhale, and then just 5 minutes of that, and you'll be away. And it just drops you into the rest and digest, rather than maybe a little bit upregulated, or you might have seen something or heard something just before bedtime. Mealtime is another classic. So mealtime, if you want to assist digestion, you want to downregulate. If again you're upregulating, you're trying to eat, then a lion walks into this room right now, Chloe, and it's like, ah, you know, and the lion kicks off. And we have an option: we can fight, flight, we can freeze, and we do multiple Fs, and then we can. That's it, right? That's an acute response. It's not a chronic response. It's an acute response. And in that acute response, we have a regulatory system. So our digestive system will cut off, right? There's no point in digesting a meal, and also it's hugely costly to digest food. So that energy is best spent to fight, flight, or freeze, or whatever we're going to do, because there's a lion in the room right now, right? So my digestion gets shut off. That means stomach acid, enzymes, all of that gone. The next one is my immune system. There's no point in fighting off a cold. I'd rather give it to the lion, you know. So immune system goes out. The final one is hormonal system. No point in producing bam-bam if there's a lion in the room. That shuts down. So what are the three things we mainly see? Are digestive issues, hormonal issues, immune system. It's simplifying it somewhat, but it's the best thing. And so with the digestive system, that's an acute response. I don't want that to be chronic. If it's chronic, there's no absorption. So you and I could be sitting in here. You might have the most incredible diet, but because you're upregulated, your digestive system's out, what are you absorbing? I might have a crappy diet right now, but be really downregulated in an amazing digestive system, I'm going to absorb more. So you'll be overfed and undernourished, you know? And so we think we're doing the right thing around food groups, but often more often it can be digestion. I find that breath is a great opportunity just to downregulate. You already feel your salivary glands coming, and it's a great practice anyway. It's a bit like saying grace or something, you know, and just preparing yourself for the food. I think it's really powerful. So again, breathing for sleep, breathing for stress, breathing for digestion. And breathing, if you're feeling low, it's an incredible practice if we really start to understand it and honor it. And I think if there's anyone with anxiety out there, or even depression, breathing is the go-to. It's one of the best practices that will help you get out the cave.
I love that idea of kind of using it as kind of a pause, and almost like a bookend before you go from work to see your kids. You stop and pause and take some breaths before you eat, before you go to sleep, to actually shift your state a bit, because often we're just going from one thing to the other and absorbing things as we go.
Absolutely.
And it's so interesting what you're saying about, you know, being on the tube and around everyone and the lighting and so often we're so, as you said, so used to that that it just seems normal and we're not even aware that it's a problem. I just got back from staying with the tribe in the Amazon.
Wow.
For 2 weeks.
Beautiful.
And I came back into London and met my boyfriend at a co-working space, and I felt like I didn't know how to exist in the city. I was like, not sure how to use, like, I don't know, the thing to get in the door, and it took me a while to get back into it because I've been so just on a different kind of level of existence.
Frequency, isn't it? It's just a completely different frequency.
Yeah. And I'm so interested to hear more about, you know. This podcast episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Is there something interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals? Therapy has massively helped me in the past to make sense of my thoughts and process my emotions. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. And you can start communicating with them in under 24 hours. BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling that's done securely online. This service is available for clients worldwide, and BetterHelp matches you with a counsellor based on what it is that you want to work on and their expertise. It's more affordable than traditional offline counselling, and financial aid is also available. BetterHelp wants you to start living a happier life today. And BetterHelp are doing a special offer for Karma U listeners. You get 10% off your first month when you visit trybetterhelp. That's betterhelp.com/karmau. That URL again, trybetterhelp.com/karmau, to get 10% off your first month's online counselling. I often think, I've had a theory, and I think you're going to, you know, prove that theory, that a lot of our anxiety is caused because we're so disconnected from our natural state.
Yeah.
And we don't actually know how good we could feel a lot of the time. We have no idea, because it's become so normalised for us to be in cities. Are there other things that you would suggest for people to be doing that can help them to connect back to that?
Absolutely. I think it's really worth highlighting that, you know, about disconnection. So I've been lucky enough to train, I mean, some incredible beings, right? But it could be from teenagers through to the elderly, like some 80-year-old clients, from students through to billionaires. Okay, flown around by private jet, amazing lifestyles, been witness to it all. But you know what? If their fundamental physical, social, spiritual needs aren't met, as in what's aligned with nature, you know, finding those natural ways of performing, they're still pretty unhappy, right? You could be incredibly wealthy and your needs aren't met, you're still pretty unhappy. And then it's establishing not what my wants are, what my needs are, you know. And so, and the good news is, but the more and more nature I kind of introduce to their lifestyles, the happier they become, but the more successful they become. I'm not talking the modern day monetary ladder of success. I'm talking to successful as human beings. That's the thing. And we very rarely understand how amazing we are. We are literally awe-inspiring. If you really understand where we've traversed, where we've come from, you know? We're talking like 200,000 years of the most incredible sapien species to get here today, right? And so imagine just the environment we would have existed in compared to where we are today. Imagine the adversity we would have faced, right? So I think it's firstly just important to just kind of get a handle on that. Just understand that inside all of us is this innately wild, connected, empowered being. That's in our DNA. It's in us, right? And just something happens along the way that pulls us off the path of divinity, let's say, right? I have my discussions around schooling and stuff like that, but I think it's just it's like a petri dish that we've been cultured into, let's say, what's been normalized in this petri dish. And Bruce Lipton's work's really great for this because it helps you understand perception as a signal. It helps you understand how cells behave. So he's like the granddaddy of epigenetics in a way.
Is he the author of Molecules of Emotion?
Yeah, and also Biology of Belief.
Oh, Biology of Belief, yeah.
Biology
that's the
of
one.
Belief.
Yeah.
So the fantastic thing is this: it could be a petri dish, and inside the petri dish is, say, a number of cells. And we are a petri dish of, say, 47 trillion cells in that dish. And what he's established is what one cell will behave, the others will behave the same way. Also, that if you take those cells and create three more petri dishes and culture those identical cells into these petri dishes, they will be cultured into whatever that environment is. So whatever your environment is today, your 47 trillion cells will adapt to it. And this is where we have a choice, and we have to choose whether we want them to adapt to good or bad, because the ultimate human experience is adaptation, and we will literally adapt to good or bad, right? But firstly, it's understanding what's good and what's bad. And for me, it's always, well, what do I put in my petri dish? So what they notice through his experience in the experiment is if you put toxic information or toxins into the petri dish, the cells go into protection, which is a bit like the sympathetic system I was talking about earlier, like fight and flight. So the system will shut down and go into protection mechanism. And we want growth to be able to understand how to thrive. So that's survival, protection. And then if you put nourishing or nutrients into the petri dish, or nourishing information into the petri dish, the cells would go into a pattern of growth. Okay, so then they're in parasympathetic, a growth promoting state. So then we need to say, right, okay, what is growth promoting? And for me, it's understanding what exists in nature again. So we could talk about, let's say, what food would we want to introduce into a petri dish? Do we want to think processed foods that we have no connection to, that are maybe monocropped, that are destroying an environment, that are covered in glyphosate pesticides, that maybe in packaging that is also destroying the environment? Do we want that in our petri dish? Or do we want to think, well, I want to have food that's in nature, which is organic, which hasn't gone through a heavy process, that I know is then growth promoting. It's full of nutrients. It's exactly where it came from. It's the earth. I am the earth. I'm part of the earth, the plants, the rocks, and the animals. I need nature to go in, right? Not something that's abnormal created in a laboratory. One will have one experience, one or the other, right? Water. Let's look at water. What kind of water would I want to put in my petri dish? Do I want municipal water that's maybe has some chemicals in it, maybe estrogen, maybe chlorine in there, because we need chlorine in there to clean because it's such an old system. Every now and then you've got the whiff of chlorine will come through your taps. Do I want that in my petri dish, or do I want to think about spring water or water systems that can purify, right? Then we can go movement. Okay, what kind of movement do I want in my petri dish? And this is tricky for us, right? Because we're a sedentary culture. I don't have any chairs in my house, right? And I don't have any chairs in there for a reason. It's because when you observe people in nature, in the natural petri dish, in that environment, they don't have chairs, right? But they have these amazing physiques. You know, we all see them on the front cover of Nature magazine, these amazing beings that have beautiful postures, beautiful physiology. and what is it they're doing differently? Because, you know, the Hadzas still sit for 9 hours a day. They just don't sit in chairs. They're on the ground. And then you observe there's like around 100 different rest positions that can be performed on the ground. And each one of those rest positions is a micro element of the macro skill of standing up and being upright and then performing, walking, running, lifting, carrying, all those things. So in the roots of that is the, a movement system that just exists on the ground. And we have one chair. So the chair goes into me, into the more protection mechanism in that Petri dish, because it unfortunately creates a compromised posture, gets us locked in the hips. We create a C-shaped spine. Core stability goes out, glutes switch off, hamstrings get tight, I get locked in the ankle. And then when I go to stand up, I'm now walking from a completely different physiological and anatomical system what I should be. Therefore, it's compromising me. Then I go to a class, like I used to have a Pilates studio, to go and unravel it somehow. But actually, if I didn't put the information in the first place, or I at least had a practice in like chair care, or I called it chair sitting offsetting now. So it's like, right, I sit for this amount of hours, right, let's get back to the ground and help unravel it. It doesn't mean yoga, it doesn't mean Pilates, it just means adopting natural sitting positions. That's what we can be doing in the Petri dish. So if you are Netflix binging at home, go on the ground and just play with different rest positions like squatting, kneeling, shin boxing, getting yoga poses or long sits or straddle sits, or there's multiple sitting positions that you can choose, which will just help your overall mobility and posture and create a stronger physical self, which then is much more powerful to go out into the world. You can absorb more in a way if your physical body is actually stronger. So that's what's that. That's movement, that's water, food. So we can look at sleep, right? So sleep's a huge one, isn't it? So we all think we have a good handle on sleep. And yet, if I start a workshop around this Petri dish model, how many hours would I need? How many hours sleep do we need? And it can be 8 hours, 7 hours, you know. And we kind of lost sight of how many hours we need individually for a start, because we're all different. But also we've lost sight of what actually happens in nature compared to what happens in the urban environment, because the urban environment is natural, so we can't really, you know, we don't get a natural outcome. So it's like, how do we understand what natural sleep is without going into nature and observing what happens there? Most of the sleep studies in the books I've read are pretty much around what happens in the laboratory experiment. So they're in sleep experiments. Is a laboratory sleep experiment going to give you a natural outcome? I'm not so sure. Yet there's Professor Siegel from the University of California went to study three different tribes, different geographic locations. And they discover that not one of those tribes people are sleeping for 8 hours. Like 99 members, 33 members in each tribe, studied for 1,165 days. No, not one of them sleeping for 8 hours. It's between 5.7 and 7 hours, that's it. What they do notice is the difference is the environment again. So the difference is in that Petri dish environment, it is there where the toxins and the growth will come in. They don't have the ability to create sunrise at sunset. So there's no sunlight ability to switch a light on, in other words, and create light. So they manage to downregulate their system. And through that, the air temperature is cooler at night, of course. They have a fire, so they always get up to tend to the fire. So they're never asleep for the whole stretch. They wake and sleep, they wake and sleep, they wake and sleep. So they look after the fire, look after the young, they fix tools, they smoke and they party. They don't have a word for insomnia. And they don't have the chronic diseases we're led to believe we would receive from a sleep debt or not achieving 8 hours. And that's, for me, was game-changing, because most of the successful people I have coming in don't have the opportunity to be sleeping for 8 hours. They're quite on it, you know, and it was really, they were getting more and more stressed, and you could see that then you would create more inflammation and more disease just from the stress of not getting the 8 hours. It's like, how do we alleviate that? Okay, look at this, guys. Not one of these people are sleeping for 8 hours. They're in amazing shape. They're incredible beings. But let's have a look underneath it, what is happening. And we know that around that fire, they're not absorbing crazy information at night. No one is saying around that fire, The village next door are going to come in here and rob us and stab us and shoot us. So that's the movie influence that we, the TV or the screen is the fire. So we want to make sure of what information am I absorbing at night. I want the romantic firelight conversations that have been passed down for generation to generation to generation and the wisdom that comes with it, rather than toxic information that's going to trigger something within me before I go into a sleep cycle. You know, and regardless whether you have a breathing approach or breath approach to downregulate, that can't go unseen. It's been seen. So your subconscious sees that as something you're entering sleep with. The other one is temperature, and then the other one is air quality. So I've now been sleeping in the same room. We've been in this apartment for a year. So I've been sleeping in the same room, the same sensory experience, the same straight lines, linear approaches for a year. And if I get the sleep studies right, then I should be in there for 8 hours. So I'm going to be breathing in and out the same materials and the same material experience for 8 hours a day for a year. You know, so really it's about, right, that's where we need to be looking at, do I want neurotoxins in the air itself? You know, because that's being kicked out from the paints, the mastics, the glues, and the materials in your room. So it's like, how do I work with that? And it can be plants, right? Okay, it's great to have nature in, so we can bring more nature in. That helps stimulate our ancestral eye. We know that taking people out into nature, they get a drop in cortisol. The same thing happens if you show someone a flick book of nature. Here's a nature scene, and they go, and they downregulate. Here's an urban setting, and they upregulate, okay? So you can go nature scenes in that environment. That will help downregulate. Plants help them purify the air. There's a huge NASA study on recommended plants, 10 recommended plants for air purification that will deal with formaldehyde, benzene, xylene, main neurotoxins. Best ones I found are like peace lilies, because you could go away for 2 weeks and you don't have to worry about them. They are so robust. Even if they're drooping, you come back, just give them a little bit of water. So you don't have to have that anxiety about, oh, my plant's going to be okay. You remove that, they're just really robust, they can cope. That's air purity. And then there's lighting. So the lighting is probably the most important, really, in the sleep realm, because again, it goes back to their ability in nature not to be able to turn the lights on. And what lighting can do is it can suppress melatonin, which we know as a sleep hormone, right? We all understand that one as a sleep hormone. It's kind of not doing it justice by just calling it a sleep hormone. So melatonin has two main processes in digestion. One is it's the regulatory system for ghrelin and leptin, two hormones. So ghrelin's process would be, if ghrelin is up, then I need to eat. The idea is you want ghrelin out, and then leptin, as leptin comes up, it says, I'm satiated, I've had enough food. So imagine they're like that. Ghrelin's here, I want ghrelin to drop and leptin to come up. Melatonin's role is ghrelin and leptin, that's its key role. So if you don't have melatonin in your system in the evening, then you face, oh, I'm really hungry right now, and the other voice of, I haven't had enough food yet. And basically by 10 p.m. at night, melatonin should be at its peak. It should be peaking at 10 p.m. So imagine if it was around the circadian rhythm or lighting experience, the sun goes down, and then by 10 p.m. those hormones are coming into play, so melatonin being one of them. That's one of its roles. And then apoptosis, which is transforming unhealthy cells into healthy cells, that process is also driven by melatonin. It's one of its key roles. And so we start to see cellular issues coming in. There's lots of studies around cancer even now with melatonin and night shift workers versus day shift workers. And so they show with night shift workers like 35% higher rates of breast cancer, prostate cancer, versus day shift. Then you look at the NHS study, they look at blind people. So blind people aren't exposed to the blue and green spectrums that would suppress melatonin, and yet they have something like 11 hours of melatonin in their system. So we know really the peak would be 11 hours if we could get to that. And if that's not enough really for the listener, they show three chambers. So there's a dark chamber, which is the sleep experiment in the laboratory. Then they show the simulated night shift worker. So he's in a brightly lit, they're in a brightly lit environment. And then they show the same night shift worker in a brightly lit environment, but wearing blue blocking glasses, which we're hearing about a lot now, right? So then when they study their urine test for melatonin in the morning, the experiment where they're in darkness, pure darkness, the laboratory, they have high melatonin. The ones that are in the simulated work experience with the bright lights have no melatonin. And the group that are wearing the blue blockers have the same levels of melatonin as the dark sleep experiment.
Oh, wow.
Exactly. It's a game changer, because then you know that you're going to sort out the digestive system. You know that you don't have to be panicking about receiving 8 hours sleep, because you're basically functioning pretty much like the hunter-gatherer that will sleep, wake, sleep, wake, sleep, wake throughout the night. So for me as a parent with 4 kids, 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, 3.5, and he's nearly 3 months now, I'd probably be dead by now if I listened to the science, right? Because we're up throughout the night, you know, it happens. We co-sleep as well. And Bo's probably one of the most noisiest eaters I've ever heard right now. And I wake with it, so I wake. But I know that my environment, my Petri dish, is set up for growth. So we have clean air in there. We don't have any toxic lighting, toxic materials, or toxic information around us at night. And therefore, I wake up in the morning and I get on with my day. I'm up at 5 a.m. I hit the mat, do some mobility, some breath work, but I'm on it, you know. And I'm also not stressed about not hitting the magic number of 8. It's all about the habit and the environment. So always think about that. And going back to the Petri dish again, think about your environment and what it is I can put in that Petri dish to make it growth promoting. That could be a simple thing like your desk. We're at a desk right now, okay? So how do I turn my desk from being a compromising desk into a growth promoting desk? Firstly, if you have natural light in there, bring something natural in. If there is no natural light, bring a nature scene in, something you can look at, but also that you're familiar with. Maybe it's a favorite walk that you go on in nature, so that your mind is already familiar with the setting and you can relate positivity to it. So it could be a favorite tree even that you sit under and you take a breath or a moment, or you read under. Or like this morning, my walk to the ponds, I love that. There's a beautiful setting there as the sun comes up over the ponds. That perfect setting, and you just have that on your desk. Again, going back to the flip book, they're showing already, studies show that that's enough to downregulate your system and connect to something natural again. And the more we connect to nature, the more we see who the authentic self is, in a way. Sitting, right? Chair care. Some HR departments are fine with standing desks, others hate it. So again, you can slide your chair away if you have the standing desk hate campaign. You just slide the chair away, hold the desk, do a few squats, and then have a little walk around and come back to your chair. So every 25 minutes, ding, timer goes off, go off, come back to your seat again. It will help creative flow rather than just blood stagnating in the hips from sitting. And the key is movement here. It's just try and get movement back into that cellular experience. Nature scenes, if you work late, blue blocking glasses. There's so many varieties out there at the moment you can really play with it. I can send you some links to some stuff for your listeners. There's some that make you look a bit more like Bono because they're quite amber, and there's that you might get away with at home. Or I've got one guy who has a band, so he started wearing those. They're quite cool. Or they have regular ones that look like reading glasses. People say, oh, I didn't know you read. I didn't know you needed glasses. No, they're just my blue blockers, you know. So that's simple. As much nature as you can bring into that environment again. And then if you can, you know, I did a talk in Santander, and we looked at the air quality in there, and it was terrible on their whole floor. So it's like, right, okay, whose responsibility is it? Like the head of their team? Okay, it's your responsibility is to clean up the air. You need air purifiers in here. You know, it's a given. It's like those guys might be in there for 10 hours and you could really smell the rubber, the glues and everything within the building. It's just they'd normalized it. So people that have been working in there for a while, they're just ignorant to it. I walk in, it was like, whoa, this is really strong in here, you know, headache by the end of the day. So, yeah, simple things like that. They're just, again, it's about emotional well-being again, isn't it? The closer you can get those needs met, you start to remove the suffering and the symptom of the environment and the experience of it. But there's also perception, isn't there? So part of that Petri dish, I think, with Bruce's work, that they notice it's also the signal that gets introduced to the Petri dish would also dictate what the reaction, whether it's protection or growth. So don't go out there freaking out that, oh, the air quality, I can't move, I can't do this, because ultimately it comes down to perception. And knowing that you have a choice. You don't have to just sit there for 8 hours a day. you do have a choice. You can move the chair back, you can hold the chair, you can do squats. You can go for a walk, you know, like the bear at the back of the cave, you know. You're stronger than I am, you get to choose. So it really is a choice. You can literally change your perception in a breath, you know, of how we're feeling. That's how powerful we are. We just lose sight of how much power we hold, I guess. Yeah.
So fascinating. And I wonder in the coming years if, you know, the governments and, you know, employers are going to have to take note of these things and design environments. Otherwise, people are going to be too sick to sort of function, I hope.
I almost think we're seeing that. We are seeing that, aren't we? We're seeing the symptoms of it. And it's almost getting younger and younger. I don't know about you, but I mean, because I'm a coach, so I see it. But originally, I'd see like 40s going into 50s burnout, you know, in the city. 20 years ago, maybe, when I first started coaching in the city. And then I started sitting in the 40s and then 30s. And I've just had 20-year-olds. I had 20s in burnout. I mean, that's seriously something showing that, you know, what is it? What's happening here? And I think partly we walk around with a permanent office in our hands, in a permanent distraction. So if I go back to, Peter Kahn, it's called generational environmental amnesia. It's kind of like we forget. And this is the new norm. So my son Beau's just been born. Animal populations, human populations, and the way the globe is right now, that's his new norm. That wasn't my new norm when I was born, and my parents' new norm and grandparents' new norm. So we know that already, say, well, it's going to be more now, isn't it? Because we lost a billion animals in Australia, right? So we could have said previously 60% of wildlife has been wiped out on the planet, right? But we've also lost sight of like what it is to be wild, right? And what it is, how do we view what's natural? Because we're losing even the natural beings of the world, like the wild beings of the world. And the ones that are there, we're not going for advice and wisdom. I posted something about Australia the other day, and it's probably a bit too soon, but it just felt like, you know, what if we actually spoke to the indigenous populations of the world to find out what it is that environment needs? Because say Australia, for instance, Aborigines have been there for 60,000 years, right? But yet we're flying in environmental and regenerative experts from different continents to look at that environment when we could be inviting them in to the table, you know? And it's kind of, almost like the amnesia part of it. We're forgetting that these people have been around for thousands of years with an ecosystem, so much so that they are still the ecosystem, they're not separate from it. So I'm sure they have some amazing wisdom to impart there, you know, even just understanding what we can probably access in ourselves, not just how we can save an environment that we inhabit today. It's just, I guess, dropping the ego somewhat and reconnecting with what would be the ecosystem as they have or as they do. So Beau's interpretation of the world is very, very, very different, you see. So for him, who knows what he's going to have in his hand? So I know there's a mobile phone here, and I know that, okay, I'm going to pick it up at some point. I'm going to look at it. And so I have that already in there. But I think Apple's original intention was that this would be an extension of you. So this actually would become an extension of you over time. The danger, again, that, you know, if I speak to a lawyer, let's say his name's Lawrence, Lawrence Middleweek is a client of mine. He's like 70. How old is Lawrence? 75, maybe. Sorry, Lawrence, if I got that wrong. And he said, when I started out, Tony, as a lawyer, I would write a letter to someone and I would have a week to respond, right? I'd have a letter would come in. I'd look at it. I'd go and do due diligence. I'd find out every little detail, and I'd make sure it's all in that one letter, because I know it would take a week to come back, and off it went. And then a week later, he'd get the response again, right? And that's how they dealt with it, right? And then he said, fast forward, the fax machine came. And then that became like 3 days, maybe a day. And then he said, the internet came. And then it was like, now it's just got to the point where it's like, boom. And he said, the problem with it, it's great. If it was a great response, but everything was accurate because people put the effort into the same effort as what they did when they were writing a letter all those years ago, I wouldn't have to keep firing emails back and forth. But people aren't as accurate in their work even now. because instant results. It's like, ah, okay. And then the anxiety comes in. Oh no, what if I don't respond in time? You know? So he's even noticed it, you know? It's like, ah, okay, he can feel how ramped up things are, and also how it must be for younger generations, because they haven't even had that as a template to understand it or experience it. And so then you don't have the mechanisms in place to deal with it as you feel it's coming in. And again, that's going back to, you know, simple things like breath work. Like my dad years ago used to sit with his eyes closed, you know, and everyone would go, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm just resting my eyes. But it was a form of rest, meditation almost, just sit there in the armchair, just zoning out. But we tend to not have that now. We kind of have a device in our hands when we should be zoning out. So again, you do have a choice there. So you have a choice maybe to put it away and put your attention back on your breath. If you're even on Instagram staring at stuff that you can feel you're upregulating and anxious, don't choose to do it. Choose to pull away from it. Even delete accounts that you find are upregulating you. Mm. You know, why even have them in there to separate from it? And just, you know, just take it upon yourself to manage yourself. You have to manage your own stress in that sense. Again, it's your petri dish, not someone else's. And your interpretation or perception of the world is entirely yours. So you and I are sitting here and we have a complete different perception of the reality of this room right now based on our experiences throughout our life, you know. How we interpret something is uniquely ours, you know.
So fascinating. I'm often thinking things at the moment to do with the climate crisis and people's anxiety around that, and whether this will almost be our way out of the fast pace of life and disconnection. Well, my hope is that we can learn to connect more with nature because of this, and that it will slow us down because we'll, I think, in a few years be working 4 days a week because the economy can't continue to grow and grow, and that might cause us to slow down. We might, you know, connect more with each other and communities more. So I'm hoping that there's a positive side to the climate issues that's going to help us to remember where we came from.
Absolutely. I think there's an element of, you know, I always take it back. I think there's an element of we have to save ourselves as well, right? So it's like save yourself before you save others. And also just be the change, I think, is the most important. Because, you know, no one likes to be told what to do, really. It's like, oh, you got to do this, you got to do that. It's really just be a great example of a human being. And don't just do it for you, you know. I mean, I have kids, so for me it was an easy one. It was like, I have kids. I mean, how do I want to be performing as a human being? I want to be the best example of a masculine as I can for my kids. I have three daughters to begin with before Beau came into the world. And it was like, well, how do I become like a mature masculine? You know, and part of that has to be this interaction with nature. I have to understand that I need them out. I need them to understand nature. I need them out in it. More so than I had when I was younger. And the more I can have them connect to nature, the more they understand they are nature, and the more chance we have of them saving nature. Because this isn't about us anymore, really. It's about the next generations, as Greta Thunberg is quite frankly pointing out, right? And so for my kids, they're out all the time. I want them to just feel that they are a bit like the indigenous populations. Again, it's like studies around play, for instance, with Peter Gray. He looks at, you know, kids in tribes, and they ask, well, how does childhood look like? And they'd ask 10 leading anthropologists, and it's like, well, it looks a bit like this. So they just play all day from infancy through to the age of 16, and they learn everything they need to learn about their adult environment, and then they walk into their adult environment. No adult intervention, no one teaches them anything. They just instinctively know what to do, and they just move into it. They've learned to track, make fire, build shelter. They've learned everything about that environment to become an adult species. So I guess we need to, as an adult species, understand that the infants through to the age of 16 are playing at being us. That's what they're doing before they move into the adult experience. So do we want them to play out being natural beings that actually want to be saving something bigger than ourselves? Or do they want to see us being destructive human beings, right? With poor habits, and things are leading to almost like the extinction of our own species, if we put it so bluntly, you know. So if you really care about your kids and you really care about raising kids, you have to understand, well, why are you raising them if you're having a toxic relationship with you and the planet? Because you have to understand there's, the chances are that they might not reach your age if that is the case, right? You know? So it's like, well, how do I be the best example of that? And again, just go look to nature, look to the more natural ways of being. And but you have to separate in a way through modalities like breathwork and meditation to become more authentic, authentically you, rather than the anxiety or stresses around you. But then, unfortunately, because we are so stressed, we bring in pacifiers and stuff to help deal with the stress, right? Which is symptom relief, right? So if I'm stressed out to the eyeballs, and I have a choice. I go out and get drunk, or I can do breath work, go and immerse myself in nature, or have a community and speak to people and sit around and communicate with others, or go and do different practices. You know, or I could smoke, or I could do this. It's just understanding, again, about the Petri dish, isn't it? And the Petri dish is nature. And it just, again, I think it's very important for us to see it that it's not really about us. It's about the generations that are observing us. That whole, it sounds cliche, that whole be the change that you want to see in the world. It's really being the change that you want them to see in the world, you know? And if you go really into the early layers of it, those first 6 years is Bruce Lipton's work again. The first 6 years are the tapes you play out for the rest of your life. They're your observations. What do we want them to observe to play out for the rest of their lives? What do we want them to normalize? You know, I'm having to rewild, reconnect and become empowered. They're innately wild, connected and empowered. Right? I have to go on retreats, workshops, go to the Amazon, drink ayahuasca, smoke toad venom, go, you know, take mushrooms, do what I do to unravel and unravel and unravel, whereas they're just innately nature. That's all they are, right? So that's our responsibility, I feel, is that's probably more important, is understanding, right, this is why we need to reconnect to nature. It's for the next generations to inherit something, to hand over, you know, that stewardship, if you like, of the planet.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that. It's absolutely fascinating. I hope that people listening can take some things, some practical things away and just get a bit more inspired. I know I've got lots of ideas now for things that I want to be changing. More plants is definitely one of them.
Oh, they're so easy as well, aren't they? I love that. I mean, nature scenes and plants, I mean, it's such an easy thing to bring in, right? Then materials. You know, just think of that. Go and have a look at simple things like biophilic design. Just research a bit of biophilic design. Then you understand it's about biophilia, bringing nature in. 83% of the UK live in urban environments. And we spend a whopping 90% of our time indoors, right? Some it's more, right? So to give you an idea, 10% outdoors would mean 2 hours, 24 minutes outdoors. And that doesn't mean in the shops, on the public transport, shopping, because that's still an indoor experience. It means actually outdoors. And so what I often ask people to do is set a timer for 2 hours 24 and try and get those gains in. And weekends are a great opportunity for that. But actually try to get to nature, try and really just immerse in nature, have that experience. That's so important for us. But it's just understanding that we have this extraordinary amount of time spent indoors. So that's one way of doing it, is to go outside for 2 hours, or we flip it and we just bring nature in, right? So just bring as much of nature into your experience you can. And this comes down to multiple layers. There's like a sensory system, and there's your microbiome, right? So your sensory system is, we could say that if we just go from the same linear experience like we're in now, this box, and this is your commute to get to here. And then you walk along the corridor, the same linear corridor, and you go down in the same lift, and then you go to the same mode of transport, and then you arrive home into the same dimensions and linear experiences as you've been doing for maybe 20 years, some people. Where's the new information? How are you expecting to, from a neuroplasticity perspective, rewire and wire your brain? You know? So it's how do you find new experiences? And so try and change your environment is one. Getting out into nature is another, but bring more nature in, because nature is forever changing. It's like it's forever changing cycles. So that will give you a new stimulus. And then there's also the microbiome. So we have microbiome kind of dysbiosis. There's an imbalance. That doesn't just mean in your gut, it means everywhere. So we're literally inhaling microbiome right now in this environment. And so I can keep that in the linear gray experience of the urban environment, or I can go out into nature and breathe nature and be in that biome, which would then create more of a symbiotic relationship because I'm back immersed into my natural habitat. There you go.
That's going to stay with me, that image.
So that's like an indoor-outdoor.
Yeah,
And understand that's who we are. And whereas in nature, again, it would have been, like with these tribes we're talking about, it's probably the flip, 90% outdoors, 10% indoors.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we balance that? And then have a play, you know, how much time you can spend outside. If you've got kids, basically hand it over to them. It's their experience. They can draw maps on where they want to take you and hand it over to them at weekends. Where do you want to go? Where can we go in nature, you know? And have them set the timers and have them. And also, there's no such thing as bad weather. It's just, you know, poor clothing choices. Just play with it. Nature's the best way to access what it is to be human, I think. The best way that you can really identify what your authentic self is once you get away from the chaos of that urban setting.
This has been so helpful. Thank you. Where can people find out more about you and what you're doing and what you offer?
Mainly on Instagram, actually. I'm known as the Natural Lifestylist, at the Natural Lifestylist on Instagram. Also, my website is tonyriddle.com. There you go, that's easy, isn't it? I forgot my own website. tonyriddle.com. And I also have some tutorials on there. So going by chair care and stuff like that, I have a squat tutorial on there which teaches people how to get to a flat-footed squat. And other rest positions that you can be choosing on the ground. So we can put a link in there to that as well. And then coming up, there'll be a fair bit of press, I think, coming up because I'm going to be running. I'm doing the Three Peaks. You know the Three Peaks?
Yeah.
And normally you drive between the peaks and you can choose 24 hours or 36 hours. And the whole distance together, including the peaks and the drive, is 485 miles. So I've decided I'm going to run the whole thing rather than drive in between. So I'm going to do the 485 running, including the Three Peaks, and I'm going to turn it around in 9 days. So three is completion and 9 is transformation. So I'm going to that's the next site.
When is that happening?
That's not till May. I'm looking to finish at the top of Ben Nevis on my 45th birthday. So I'm super pumped about that. I'm really looking forward to that. And again, I'm gonna pull it back around into sustainability and the environment as create a platform for the bigger picture, which is our environment that we should all be putting our attention on right now, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant. I look forward to following your journey with that. Thank you so much.
Thank you
so much for listening. I really hope that you gained a lot from this episode. Come on over to Instagram and let me know. What are you taking from this episode? Find me at Chloe Brotheridge. And I would love it if you would leave me a review in the podcast app or in iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, leave me a rating. And is there someone in your life that would really benefit from this podcast? You can let them know by sharing this podcast. I'd be so, so grateful. So I'm just wishing you a wonderful week ahead, sending you loads of love. Hopefully you'll tune in again and I'll see you soon. I have a load of free resources on my website to help you to become your calmest self. Head on over to calmeryou.com/free to grab those freebies now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.